You're listening to the Synthetic Zen Show, but we're going to start out with the Tech Talk with Hawk segment. Tonight's show for the Synthetic Zen, before I get into Tech Talk, is going to be Celtic music. That's what I'll be doing for the music segment of the show after I get through the technology talk. For those of you just tuning in, the Synthetic Zen Show is normally a music show that starts out with a beat and gets mellower and mellower as we go, playing all kinds of music. Starting out with techno and rock and punk and funk and jazz and blues, and then getting a little mellower and new age, and then lots of world music and meditative and trance music, a little classical here and there. So that's how the normal Synthetic Zen Show goes. Again, though, tonight it will be Celtic music. And then for the Tech Talk with Hawk segment, I talk about how technology affects privacy, civil rights, and security and other aspects of your life that you may find of significance. I'm a retired computer scientist. I first started programming on computers when I was about 11 years old in 1981, and in good old BASIC and later languages. And I've been a chief technology officer at companies and a lot of other positions and worked my way up. Retired a few years ago, but I'm still very much plugged in. I also tend to take more of an open source perspective to things. Open source means that you can see the source code and modify it as you want. Some people may have heard of Linux and Mozilla Firefox. Those are some, and OpenOffice. Those are some flagships of the open source community. There are many, many products out there. Totally non-commercial. And the main point is, well, there's other technology shows out there, but they're pretty much either trying to sell you something or don't cover a perspective that hopefully I'm able to bring out. I've done a few of these shows, and a lot of people have commented saying basically, wow, I did not know that. That's really new information, and so hopefully can keep providing that for you. So tonight's show for, again, later on with Synthetic Zen will be Celtic music, but for now with Tech Talk with Hawk, I'm going to give you a little bit of trivia. This isn't really related to Tech Talk, but it's related to what's going on with radio and this day in history. So hopefully you'll find this of interest. Just one moment. And that was Utah Saints, Technology. They spelled it as a combination of technical or technology with knowledge, K-N-O-W-L-E. Jay, so it's technology. Well, broadcast radio turned 100 years old this Christmas Eve. This is from, I'm going to be reading a few articles from slashdot.org. Their subtitle is News That Matters, Stuff for Geeks, etc. But this is Grayrill wrote. On Christmas Eve, 1906, a Canadian physicist named Reginald Fessenden presented the world's first wireless radio broadcast from his transmitter at Brant Rock, Massachusetts. The transmission included Christmas music and was heard by radio operators on board U.S. Navy and United Fruit Company ships equipped with Fessenden's wireless receivers at various distances over the South and North Atlantic and in the West Indies. Fessenden was a key rival of Marconi in the early 1900s, who, using Morse code, succeeded in passing signals across the Atlantic in 1901. Fessenden's work was the first real departure from Marconi's damped wave coherer system for telegraphy, and represented the first pioneering steps toward radio communications and radio broadcasting. Fessenden later became embroiled in a long-running legal dispute over the control of his radio-related patents, which were eventually acquired by RCA. If you want to read more about that, you can swing by slashdot.org and look for the keyword broadcast radio turns 100. Some news on the search engine and how your privacy is not as private as you might think. Google search convicts hacker. This is from an anonymous reader, writes, Google search terms have helped convict a wireless hacker. The queries the hacker performed were introduced into evidence at court, where Matthew Schuster was charged with disrupting his former employer's wireless network and imitating other users' MAC addresses to obtain access. From the article, court documents are ambiguous and don't reveal how the FBI discovered his search terms. They could have happened in one of three ways: an analysis of his browser's history and cache, an Alpha employee monitoring the company's wireless connection, or a subpoena to Google from the police for search terms tied to his internet address or cookie. Google has confirmed that it can provide search terms if given an internet address or web cookie, but it's steadfastly refused to say how often such requests arrive. So just to, if some of that was a little bit too much techno speak for you, basically what happened was there was a former employee. 70% of all security compromises in a company are usually because of either an existing or previous employee, so it's usually internal compromise when it comes to technology, hacking, and such. It's about 60, 70, almost 80% of the time that you can count on it having been somebody internal. And he talks about, basically, he was looking up on the web the information on how to take over a wireless network and pretend to be somebody else's wireless card. So, for example, the company had a wireless network in their office for their users, and they had it locked into a specific address so that only that card was supposed to be able to get onto the wireless network. And system administrators do this as a level of security, thinking that it protects them. And it helps. I mean, it makes it harder to get on a network, but what he was able to find, and it's pretty easy to find, is that you can pretend to be that address of that card, especially if that computer's not in there right now or if they just bump them off when they are connected. And so he was doing that, and apparently they were able to gather that information to show that he did the research to hack in that way. And the question is, did Google hand over that information? But all three of those options should let you know that, you know, you're not, things are not as private as you might think they might be. And next piece here, this is regarding a Vista. Windows Vista is the next version of Windows coming out after XP. That's in the final release stages here. And this is Vista exploit surfaces on Russian hacker site. And how's that spelled? Datamation writes, exploit code for Windows Vista, though at this point only a proof of concept code, has been published to a Russian hacker site, eWeek reports. Certain strings sent through the message box API apparently cause memory corruption. Though this is obviously cause for concern at the moment, it would seem access to the system would already be required to make use of the exploit, so it's not a huge hole at this point. Determina has an analysis of the bug just last week. Trend Micro reported that Vista zero-day days are being sold at underground hacker sites for $50,000. So let me again turn that from technology speak into layman's terms. So again, latest version of Windows, before it's even really out there, already having some exploits. This one isn't a huge one to be worried about, but something to watch for. But what they mean by zero days are worms, viruses, attacks, exploits against computer systems that are not yet known. In other words, they've been out there 0 days. The antivirus companies don't know anything about it. The government doesn't necessarily know anything about it. So they're brand new attacks. The real hackers tend to come up with these 0 day exploits rather than the script kiddies wannabes out there. Script kiddies are people who use software that's already been written by somebody else, and they just literally can just click a button. There's one called Red Button that script kiddie would use, and all they have to do is type in a website address and then click this big red button, and then it goes out and attacks and goes out and takes over systems, etc., especially Windows computers. And they don't really understand how it's doing it, why it's doing it, what exactly is going on. They're just running the program, and so they're called script kiddies. They're running existing scripts, and they're just little kids as far as their understanding of security and compromising. Whereas the real hackers write the new stuff that later on they might trade for other software, things like that down the road in chat rooms, etc. And now they've upped the ante. They're selling zero-day exploits against the new Windows Vista at $50,000 a pop. These can be used to do some serious damage to the next versions of Windows. And just a reminder here, and as you're listening to KYRSLP Spokane, studio number is 509-747-3807. You can also listen to us online at www.kyrs.org, as well as FM 89.9 and 92.3. And Stephen just walked in to give me a CD from the previous show. I want to thank him very much for letting me be on there and keep up the great work with your show. I really enjoyed listening to it. That's the Spokane Open Poetry reading show on just before my show. Thank you. Right. And you have a very Merry Christmas.
You too.
Take care. Drive safe. So, pardon that. So, and also you can listen to archives of my shows, and I will be putting up the Tech Talk with Hawk segments as separate segments from the Synthetic Zen show, so you'll be able to download either the music segment or the Tech Talk segment from my website at www.synthzen.com. That's SYNTHZEN.com. Now, I've just been changing over server software, so I don't have all of the archives up there yet, but if you go ahead and register, you'll be able to download them as they become available. And it usually takes me about 2 or 3 days to get them up on the site for download. All right, next piece here. Judge rules against deep linking of content. An anonymous reader wrote, a Texas judge has ruled that if a copyright owner objects to the linking of content from another website, that link must be taken down. This case, which may have some far-reaching implications, centered around the Motocross website. The site, run by Robert Davis, provided links directly to live feeds of Supercross events streaming from the SFX Motorsports site. The company filed suit, claiming that the direct links were denying it advertising revenue. The article cites previous cases where sites were prohibited by judges from linking to files which violated copyright law, such as DVD decryption software. That would be DECSS, by the way. From the article, but in those lawsuits, the file that was the target of the hyperlink actually violated copyright law. What's unusual in the SFX case is that a copyright holder is trying to prohibit a direct link to its own website. There is no evidence that SFX tried any technical countermeasures, such as referrer logging and blocking anyone coming from Davis's site. So, what this could mean to the average Joe out there. If you have a web page and you see a favorite music video you like on MySpace or whatever, or just a favorite image at some art site, and you decide to link straight to the image rather than to the page with all the advertising on it, so that somebody can be on your site and you say, I was looking at this piece of artwork and I thought it was really great, here's the link, click on it and go look at it. And you get to see the image. Well, they're saying basically, and the courts, the judge is holding this up, that by doing so, you're robbing that company of advertising revenue and committing a crime for linking directly to the content, which is kind of what the internet's all about, is the hyperlinking between content. So I watched all this happening in the late 90s and early 2000s with the DECSS. DECSS is the, I've talked about in previous shows, CSS is the encryption used to protect DVDs from copying. Protect used very loosely, since it was hacked 2 weeks before it was made available to the public. But they still went ahead without changing it, because the movie industry had already invested so much into it, they didn't want to try to make any effort to do something better. And they managed to get the Digital Millennium Copyright Act pushed into place. That basically says any attempt to bypass any copy protection, no matter how feeble it is a crime, and you can do 20 years for it. I'm of course paraphrasing here, but basically any efforts to bypass any even meager protection is in violation of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, and so don't do that. Well, the problem is that the DVDs wouldn't play in a lot of different computer systems, for example, Linux or OpenBSD or other systems. Excuse me. And so they used DECSS to make it so they could play DVD movies in their Linux systems. And so there were sites making available the download of DECSS all over the web, both the United States and elsewhere. And what happened was the government went around and started shutting down all these sites and threatening them to be in violation of the DMCA just for linking to it. So, for example, at first the site, the DECSS software was actually on the server saying, here, you can download this so you can watch DVDs on your Linux computer, etc. So the first wave was the government went around and said, you can't carry this. This is in violation of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. Get rid of it because it's helping bypass encryption. So servers got rid of that here in the United States. Then they went after any sites that linked to sites outside of the country. So, for example, if you had a web server here in the United States and you linked to a server over in Norway that had the DECSS, and you weren't linking to the download, you just linked to the site that had the download. They then told you to cease and desist, remove the link, or you'd be in violation of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act because you're providing information that allows you to bypass the encryption on DVDs. Once they managed to shut down all those sites in the United States, then they started to try to work with WIPO, the World Intellectual Property Organization, and WTO, World Trade Organizations, and the agreements with other countries, and start going after any of the servers hosting DECSS in other countries. So first it started in the U.S. and it spread. So this was pretty nasty, and then one particular organization tried fighting it intensely. It was the 2600 magazine, a.k.a. the Hacker Quarterly, excuse me. And they went to court over it. They fought it tooth and nail and unfortunately lost and lost on appeal. And so they were forced to remove the links and the information on it. But during it, they made a bunch of T-shirts, which I'm a proud owner of one, with the entire source code to DECSS printed, or at least the whole algorithm and such, printed on the T-shirt, kind of giving the finger to those powers that would try to suppress free speech, etc. Anyway, so DECSS now is still really easy to get. Plenty of sites out there make it available. The pressure kind of backed off after the first wave of harassment, or kind of cyber terrorism, as some people would translate it as. But its legacy has been left, and as you can see that right here. So that happened back in the late 90s, very early 2000, and now they're citing 6 years later an example of, well, you're not allowed to link to DECSS. You shouldn't be allowed to link to video that was freely available because it's bypassing advertising dollars. This is why what seemingly innocuous things and why people need to be aware of and concerned about these things, because it affects everybody at every level. If you have your favorite MySpace site and you're linking to some of your favorite things on other websites, now people can come after you and say, hey, you're violating copyright law and you need to remove the content. Even though what you were doing was basically, in effect, promoting it and not in any way trying to take away or make money from the other person's intellectual property. So just something to be aware of, and I'll keep bringing up topics like this throughout the shows. Here's an interesting one. Oh my goodness. Republican aide tries to hire hackers. Now, I'm not picking any sides here, but this is a specific article that, oh my goodness. So Noryunga writes, it seems as though a Republican communications director contacted attrition.org. Attrition.org is a well-known hacker site, trying to hire hackers to improve his educational records. I don't know what is his dumbest move. Again, I'm quoting here Noryunga. A, contacting attrition in the first place. B, using a real name Yahoo email address. Or C, speaking at length about what he needed. Kudos to the attrition crew for posting the whole email dialogue online. A sample from the conversation follows. Jericho, first, let's be clear. You're soliciting me to break the law and hack into a computer across state lines. That is a federal offense and multiple felonies. Obviously, I can't trust anyone and everyone that mails such a request. You might be an FBI agent, right? So I need three things to make this happen. One, a picture of a squirrel or pigeon on your campus. One, close up, one with background that shows buildings, a sign, or something to indicate you are standing on the campus. Two, the information I mentioned so I can find the records once I get into the database. 3. Some idea of what I get for all my trouble. So basically this guy wanted to make his college records be a little bit better than they were. He wanted somebody to hack in and fluff up his school records. And so he sent an email that had his actual real name and address and everything from a Yahoo account, but had his real info, to a hacker site asking them to hack in and modify his records. Oh my goodness. So I thought that was very interesting. I don't have a whole lot of commentary other than that. That seemed to be a pretty good chuckle. Here's another one. This is related to a file sharing, peer-to-peer networking. Some would remember things like Napster and Grokster and other peer-to-peer file sharing networks, and the ongoing battle between the Recording Industry Association of America and the Motion Picture Association of America, RIAA, MPAA, and their constant harassment of people using peer-to-peer file sharing, which has a lot of legitimate uses, but also, of course, like any tool, can be misused. But they've sued dead people and little old ladies and six-year-old girls, and they go on and on and on with their harassment. And what's been happening is the courts, there's been a backlash in recent years. The courts are saying, hey, now wait a minute, you're really abusing the whole due process here. For a while there, they were doing en masse lawsuits, so they would file a single suit. So this is kind of the reverse of a class action lawsuit. They would file one lawsuit against 500 John Does for the IP addresses and such through the ISP, saying they were all file sharing illegal copyrighted material, rather than filing separate cases after each individual John Doe. And at first the courts were letting them get away with it, but after a couple of years, finally one judge stood up and said, no, wait a minute, you know, that violates due process. You have to file a separate court case for each individual defendant. And and let me make sure I get my comment in here. I'm not a lawyer, have no law background, just technology background. The opinions expressed are not necessarily those, I need to remember to add this to the show regularly, are not necessarily those of KYRS, its members, or any of the stations, just solely my own or opinion or read reviews read from other sites as I've quoted here. Okay, and I'll remember to make that regular routine here. So, so the court said you have to file one case per defendant, etc. And of course, that slowed down the Recording Industry Association, Music Motion Picture Association's efforts at harassing people left and right. In this case, the judge is saying that just sharing your file folder is not enough to convict. So I'll read this article. It's from a New York County lawyer writes in. In UMG versus Lindor, Judge David G. Trager rejected Ms. Lindor's objection to a magistrate's report in which Ms. Lindor complained that the report could be read to imply that the mere presence of a shared files folder on an individual's computer would satisfy the requirements of 17 U.S.C. 16.3 or 106.3, saying that the report of Magistrate Robert M. Levy could not be so read since the report and recommendation does not comment on whether or not the mere presence of a shared files folder satisfies that code. Instead, it makes clear that plaintiffs will have the burden of proving actual sharing. Imagine that. Report and recommendation at trial, plaintiffs will have the burden of proving by a preponderance of the evidence that defendant did indeed infringe plaintiff's copyrights by convincing the fact finder, based on the evidence plaintiffs have gathered, that defendant actually shared sound files belonging to the plaintiffs. So what they're saying is, just because you have a folder that's sharing files doesn't mean you're automatically guilty of sharing the files that the, in this case, the Recording Industry Association is saying you were sharing. Just because the folder's there does not automatically make you guilty. There has to be evidence of the actual files themselves that they are going after you being in that folder. So that was a nice ruling for a change. We'll see if they try to appeal that or not. Top viruses, worms, and malware in 2006, an anonymous reader wrote. HNS is running an article with a list of those malicious codes which, although they may or may not have caused serious epidemics, stood out in one way or another. Some of the categories are the biggest snooper, the most moralistic, the worst job applicant, and the most tenacious. From the article, the most competitive, once the pop-upper spyware has installed itself on a computer, it runs a pirate version of a well-known antivirus application. Far from trying to do the user a favor, however, it is actually trying to eliminate any possible rival from the computer. It seems that the fight for supremacy has also reached the world of internet threats. So a little bit. And so there's a whole article on that at net-security.org. And again, these are articles from slashdot.org. I'll read a few from EFF later on. And it's Panda Software was publishing that list. And here's the list. The most moralistic award goes to spyware Zcodec, which, among other actions, monitors whether users access certain web pages with pornographic content. It's simply a way of determining whether the user is a frequent visitor to the types of pages in order to send personalized advertising. On the other hand, perhaps the author of spyware just has voyeuristic tendencies. Again, I'm quoting from the net-security.org site. The worst job applicant, the elite, or Elilays, E-L-I-L-E-S dot A worm, sends out CVs, resumes, all over the place. It even sends them out to users' cell phones. It would seem that it has little confidence in its own job prospects. the most sensationalist. Sensational headlines have always made an impact. Now they are even being used by viruses. Of all those that appeared in 2006, Noir.a wins hands down with its declaration of the start of the Third World War. The most tenacious. They say that all good things come to an end. It's a shame that the creators of the Spamta worms haven't heard the saying. Otherwise, they might have stopped sending wave after wave of almost identical variants of this malicious code. Which, of course, makes it a lot easier to stop if it's the same thing. The most competitive. And so I just read to you that about the antivirus one. The most diligent. In general, phishing messages. So phishing, in case you haven't already learned this term, this is important for protection against identity theft. You would get an email, let's say, from your bank saying, hey, we lost your login information. Could you please click this link and enter your password and social security number and account numbers, etc., so we can update our records, etc. There's a lot of variations on that. Some are a lot more clever than others. And so that's a phishing, and that's spelled P-H-I-S-H-I-N-G. And there's websites that do it. You'll get emails that do it. So this is the most diligent. In general, phishing messages are aimed at gathering confidential information such as credit card numbers or account access details in order to steal money. However, this isn't the case with Barkphish, that's barcphish.html, which goes much further, collecting information including expiration dates, card verification values, CVVs, last names, membership numbers, five-digit codes, account numbers, etc. No doubt the creator was thinking better too much information than too little. The biggest snooper, in this case, it was not a difficult choice. Webmic, WEBMIC.A, is a malicious code that can record sounds and images using a microphone and webcam connected to the computer. Of course, this is not the sort of uninvited guest you would like to have on your PC, so it can turn on your microphone and webcam and start recording against your will. The most mischievous, Nedro.b, is a worm that seems to get bored after it has infected a computer. Perhaps that's why it decides to change icons, prevent access to tools, hide file extensions, delete options from the start menu, and basically cause chaos. Maybe this seems entertaining to someone, but it certainly isn't for the users. The most chaste. Malicious codes that spread across peer-to-peer networks use enticing file names in order to get users to download them voluntarily to their computers. For this reason, many of these names have pornographic connotations. However, among the more than 37,000 different names used by the formshared.a worm, none of them make any reference to sex. That's some kind of record. The most archaic. Seemingly, there are still some retrovirus creators around. Whoever created the darkfloppy.a worm appears not to have heard of email, instant messaging, or peer-to-peer systems, as the propagation methods they've chosen to spread this malicious code is floppy disks. Not much chance of a massive epidemic, then, is there? The most promiscuous. This title goes without doubt to GAT.A. This malicious code can infect any platform that is run on. Windows, Linux, Mac OS X, you name it. The most deceitful. Safety Bar supposedly offers security information and anti-spyware downloads. However, the problem is that once downloaded, these programs then warn the user the computer is infected by non-existent threats. So that just gives you a little bit of idea of the top 10 worms and malware in 2006 as based on net-security.org's top 10 list. Here's an interesting one. This is related to open source. I always try to cover at least some open source topics. Let people realize that you do have choices out there besides the few that are kind of shoved down people's throats. Again, that's just opinion, but the choices seem limited, and yet they are out there if you know about them. The key is getting the word out that there are choices. Librarians stake their future on OSS, that's open source software. Systems Librarians writes, this is from Slashdot.org, Linux.com is running a story entitled Librarians Stake Their Future on Open Source. It details a group of librarians at the Georgia Public Library Service that have developed an open-source, enterprise-class library management system that may revolutionize the way large-scale libraries are run. The system is evergreen. The element of this project is that the participants are especially excited in its speed. Previously, if users wanted changes to their systems, they'd be put into an enhancement queue, request queue. Now, some features are implemented overnight. From the article, in fact, the catalog, and this is the article at open-ils.org and also at enterprise.linux.com. In fact, the catalog has many features and innovations that are lacking in non-free systems. It does on-the-fly spell check and gives search suggestions and adds additional content such as book covers, reviews, and excerpts. The shelf browser shows items ordered along a virtual shelf built out of the holdings of the entire system. Patrons can create book bags, which are lists that contain a selected collection of annotated titles. Book bags can be kept private or shared as a regular web page or as Atom or RSS feeds. Linux.com and /dot are both owned by OSTG's open source group, the advocacy group. So a little interesting information there about where open source, yet another area that open source is appearing and giving a lot of benefit. This next one is about SCO and its lawsuits with IBM relating to open source and Linux, etc. The SCO asks court to reconsider IBM's dismissal. VE3OGG writes, the SCO group, the litigation firm currently in dispute with, among many, IBM, over supposed copyright-infringing code in Unix, has quietly asked the courts to reconsider IBM's request to toss the case out. SCO argued that the court's November decision was procedurally and substantially flawed, and that they say the rules of procedure do not support such a result under the circumstances of this case. If allowed to reopen the case, the SCO group argues that new evidence would present itself through the deposition of several IBM programmers who had previously been interviewed. So this whole SCO thing, it's just dragged on for years and years and years and years and years. And I mentioned some of this in previous broadcasts. Basically, they're saying that there's proprietary code in some of the Linux distributions out there, but they won't specify which code. And so what they're doing is they're demanding that anybody who's selling Linux, or even not even selling it, that if you're getting Linux through the distribution, let's say Red Hat and IBM and others, that you owe SCO Unix a $500 seat license. I don't remember the exact amount, but it was a few hundred dollars for the code. They want you to pay a few hundred dollars for that. So what this did is it effectively scared off a lot of companies. Huge enterprises were converting over to Linux, and this kind of put a screech on it. And it turns out there was a lot of funding coming in through the back door through Microsoft's venture funding organizations to keep SCO propped up and able to fund these. Now, that's not to say that that's exactly what they funded them for. It's just one of those things that a lot of people point out, that the lawsuit started shortly after a very substantial investment from Microsoft's investment companies. And it has had the effect of slowing down adoption of Linux and open source software in the enterprise environments. That's large corporations. Because in 2001, 2002, there was a huge transition. A lot of people were switching over very quickly. As many as 10, 15,000 computers at a time were going from Windows to Linux products and other open source products. And this really put a damper on it, because now what happened was people were afraid that their organization would get a mention in these lawsuits by SCO and such. And so because of the intellectual property contention, people stopped doing the switch until this was resolved. So it's in SCO's and the investor who has an interest in this to drag this out indefinitely. So what happened is IBM kept demanding and said, well, show us the proof. Show us the source code that you're talking about that you say is in violation. And the SCO says, no, we can't show that to you. We can only show it to the courts. And, of course, the courts don't have the judges didn't have the technical ability to look at the code and really understand what was going on there. And you're supposed to, the IBM is supposed to be able to see what they're being accused of. And so this went back and forth and back and forth for years. Finally, IBM said, listen, if they're not going to show the evidence of what we're supposedly in violation of, throw this out of court. This is ridiculous. And finally, the judges suspended it. And now SCO is saying, now, wait a minute, don't do that. That was too easily dismissed. We want you to reopen the case. We have evidence now. And of course, this is happening. The last time it happened just before Windows XP came out, and now this is happening just as Windows Vista is coming out. Might just be a coincidence. Might be. But just some interesting correlational data there. So that's something to be aware of. But meanwhile, the Linux distributions have continued on, and nobody's been stuck doing that. There have been some people who've jumped the gun and went ahead and paid anyway. But that's how much they wanted to use Linux. They ended up paying more for Linux seats than they would have for Windows seats, because they just wanted to have what they felt was a better platform to run on. And they went ahead and paid something that's really looking, we'll see what the courts rule. So, here's another interesting, this is actually directly about Microsoft. Microsoft applies to patent RSS in Vista. All right, so Vista, again, I mentioned earlier, is the new version of Windows coming out. RSS is the news feed you get. When you let's say you have a favorite blog you like to follow, or you like an iPodcast, there's a file there called an RSS feed. There's a few other names and such. And it's just a text file that says, here's the latest stuff that's up to date as of this time, in the last half hour, the last 24 hours, whatever. And that's how you get your little news subscriptions to show you the latest news on that website, so that you can click a link when you see something interesting from your newsreader. Or if you're using podcasting, all it is an RSS saying, here's the latest MP3 file that's available for download. That's through an RSS feed, and they call it podcasting. So Microsoft wants to apply a patent for RSS feeds that are in Vista, so I'll continue reading from the article here. Syveros wrote in with a link to Wired's Monkey Bytes blog, which is featuring a post on Microsoft applying for a patent on RSS. The article points out, this isn't as crazy as it seems at first blush, according to this guy, from the wording of the application, post author Scott Gilbertson interprets their move as a patent on RSS only within Vista and Internet Explorer 7. From the article, the big mystery is what Microsoft is planning to do with the patents if they are awarded them. The sad state of patent affairs in the United States has led to several cases of Microsoft being sued for technologies they did arguably invent simply because someone else owned a generic patent on them. Of course, we have no way of knowing how Microsoft intends to use these patents if they are awarded them. They could represent a defensive move, but they could be offensive as well. Self-described RSS inventor Dave Weiner may end up being correct. It would be nice to see Microsoft release some information on what they plan to do with these patents. But for now, we'll just have to wait and see whether the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office grants them. So that's just a little something interesting there. And I'm going to go ahead and wrap up the Tech Talk with Hawk segment. I hope that gives you some useful information about what's going on. There's a lot, lots and lots of stuff going on. Hoping eventually to have a whole one-hour show each week dedicated just to Tech Talk, and then I'll stick with music for the Synthetic Zen show. But for now, they're a mix, and I hope you've enjoyed it. Again, you'll be able to download archives of my shows at my website, www.synthzen.com. That's SYNTHZEN.com. And I'm here every Sunday, 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. right here on KYRS. Now we're going to go ahead and get into some Celtic music of various kinds. And we'll start out with some Enya.